Welcome to the Workflow Show. My name is Jason Whetstone, Senior Workflow Engineer at Chesapeake Systems. This is
episode 38,
The Codec Wars. And with me in the studio, as usual, I have my co-host, Ben Kilberg, Senior Solutions Architect. Hi, Ben.
Hi there.
How you doing?
Good.
Awesome. So the Codec Wars, what are we talking about today? We're talking about all of these different sort of camera formats and codecs and how this information is captured on this non-volatile media that needs to be ingested into your NLE or your MAM or your SAN or whatever it is you're working on and doing post-production on. So, you know, all these cameras have their native formats, and every manufacturer has their idea of what the best way to store that information, compress that information, get it all on one card. What does the manifest look like? How many files are we talking about? They all have different ways of doing this, and that makes our job and your job a little bit of a nightmare. So we're going to just kind of pull that apart a little bit today and talk about if anybody's figured it out, if there are any solutions out there on the table. And with us today, we have over the internet's waves of internet, we have Nick Smith of JB&A Distribution. Nick is the Vice President of Technology at JB&A. How's it going, Nick?
Oh, pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. Thanks for taking the time. So let's just start off a little bit talking about JB&A and Nick and what you do for JB&A. So what is your role there? How long have you been there? Let's start there.
Coming up on 9 years. I can't believe it's been that long already, but here I find myself 9 years later. I guess the easiest way to explain it is I'm a translator. I help people understand the technology. In layman's terms, in technical terms, whichever side they may find themselves. But I typically sit between the manufacturers and the resellers and the systems integrators and the end users to help them understand what these products are supposed to do for them and how they would better work together.
Yeah, I would imagine you find yourself in front of varying degrees of technical understanding and know-how on all of these different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Here. The ones who just want to have a single button to push to the ones who really want to understand the ins and outs on the backside of the box. Yeah, it's all over the map, which makes it fun because it challenges me to learn how to communicate in different ways. Cool. You know, how do I step it up? How do I step it down on a daily basis?
So it strikes me that that JB&A and Chesa have a little bit in common. So how do we work together? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I mean, JB&A's goal here is we bring products to market. We help manufacturers find a pathway to the end users. And through that, we do it through the channel. And through the channel for us is partners like Chesa who understand the technologies and can implement them and be the feet on the street holding their clients' hands through the process. And so we look for partners like you all that can be that for the end user because we can't be everywhere, nor do we want to be everywhere. But we want to work with partners who can see their clients' needs, sort of meet it out from day to day. And so we find partners like yourselves. We work with you all to take these technologies to your clients, to your end users, the ones that really, really need them. And so for us, it's all about channel business and, helping these manufacturers find avenues into that channel.
So the technology supply chain goes from vendor to distributor to reseller or integrator and to the client. And you guys are that distributor stop. So you help sort out like what's a good vendor, what's a bad vendor, what's a good product, what's a bad product. And then you bring it to us as the distributor, as the reseller
slash integrator.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm going to need a copy of this recording later because that was perfectly put for the tech explainer. You just did it in 30 seconds or less. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
And part of the reason we figured out is the manufacturers that sell direct have too much time invested in that one client and they can't focus on their technology. Mm-hmm. But the manufacturers who allow the channel to facilitate that business and connect that technology into the rest of the ecosystem, those end users have a better experience.
Sure. Right? That's sort of quintessential example of maybe a software vendor who's doing their own deployments into an environment that maybe has storage, networking, archive, all of these different technologies and components that vendor cannot possibly be an expert in. They, we, you know, we would hope that they're an expert in their own software, but just because you're an expert in your own software doesn't mean you're an expert in SAN versus NAS or you know, how they work differently, how they work similarly, object storage versus LTO, tape archive, how they work differently from each other. So that's where we want to lean on an integrator maybe for something like that. Right. So so JB and I really helps us sort of qualify those products.
Yeah, in my mind, an engineer isn't somebody who focuses on what one product does, but what the impact of the products to the left and to the right of it. Right.
Absolutely.
What is the bigger picture? How does the data flow? How does the signal flow? And by placing this component in the data stream, what's the impact to all the files or the pieces downstream of that? Right. That's what we as engineers have to be looking at, is that bigger picture. And that's sort of what I focus on in the company, is taking these manufacturers, helping them understand what their role is in the ecosystem, how to connect to other products in the ecosystem, and then how to create bigger solutions out of that.
Nice.
So how the heck did you get started doing that?
Tell us the story of how you got into this crazy business.
Yeah, really. So I truly grew up in a barn in the woods. It's kind of sad. So my parents moved me from Carmel, California, near the ocean when I was young, to south of Lake Tahoe in the middle of the woods with no electricity. We got the first telephone on the hill, but we always had computers. My dad was... realized early on that, you know, this technology thing was amazing. And so the first Macs that came out, we had them. We had to turn on a generator to run them, but we had, you know, the computers, and we were learning programming.
Hold on a second. You literally had to use a generator to power your computer. Like, you weren't kidding when you said no electricity.
No, literally no electricity. So we had, we used a wood cook stove to heat water for, you know, showers. We cooked in that stove. We didn't get electricity to that house, I think, till like 15 years later. But my dad had taken a old engine and converted it to a propane generator. We had a switch in the house, so when it was time to do homework on the computer, you fired up the generator. Of course, you had to, you know, plan things out. You were also going to wash clothes during that time. You know, did anything that required electricity, you planned it out. And including watching Knight Rider on Friday nights with my brothers. And, you know, I mean, there was things like that. It was all about, you know, planning. But we had the technology. And, you know, and it's kind of funny because there were five boys, all but one went into technology. They're all working for big tech companies. They're all, you know, in technology. But we came from a very technologically devoid area, so to speak.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So your dad... was he running from a foreign government who's trying to destroy him? Is your last name really Born?
Yeah, I wish. That would be so much more fun. No, my dad was a car mechanic. Actually, I call him mad scientist, really and truly. He designed just so many strange ways of doing things. And I think my way of thinking, and this is a bad word, I'm going to reference it, but out of the box, comes from him and comes from his approach to doing things different. We had, you know, rather than run kerosene lanterns in the house, we had low voltage 12 volt lighting throughout the house, which was powered off of big truck batteries. But when you ran the generator, it would recharge those. So you'd have this point in the day when the lights would start to dim a little bit and you go, okay, it's time to run the generator, charge the batteries up a little bit, run the house a little bit more. And so he always thought differently and tried to come up with different ways. He, even as a mechanic, he built some of his own tools because he'd recognize there's a better way to do this. Nobody's doing it for me, so I'll do it. I'll build the tool, the jig, I'll weld it together, and I'll come up with a better way of solving this problem.
Got it. So your dad is an alien scientist hiding from the intergalactic star police.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we had CompuServe, we had AOL, so we weren't, you know, totally out of the, you know, connection with the world.
That explains,
you know,
so
from
much.
That perspective. Yeah, it does.
That's pretty fantastic. And I think I don't know that, Ben, that you and I have talked about our background stories, but
sure.
I thought, you know, I thought we were roughing it. You know, I grew up in a log house. My family still lives there. My entire family still lives in that log house. And
nice.
And it's funny you said about not getting electricity in that house until about 15 years later. My parents did not get air conditioning in their house until my sister and I went to high school and college. Actually, I think it was when my sister went to college. That would have been 4 years after I left the house. They finally decided to get air conditioning. And I remember just like you know, my sister and I were just like, what? Mom and Dad are going to get air conditioning.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah. And I thought we were roughing it because I'd go over to my friends' houses and it would be so nice and cool in their house and just like, right. You know.
And they had cable TV with that cool rotary control. It was quickly between channels. Yeah.
But no,
I had an antenna on the top of a tree.
So. Awesome.
No, what I wanted to pick up on there about your story was just doing something differently than anyone's ever done before, seeing a need and just sort of, you know, grasping the opportunity to make something better, which I think is something that we all have in common here. I mean, I see that in a lot of people that we talk to on a regular basis in this industry, including all of my coworkers here at Chessa. But we are here to talk a little bit about codecs and what is going on in the industry today. So what do you see going on? What do you see good, the bad, the ugly, specifically about these codecs? What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, on the good side, you know, if we follow Moore's law, things are getting faster and better, right? Mm-hmm. And that's another bad word I never like to use, is Moore's law. But from the concept of being able to generate codecs at a chip level now, and you look at Mac with Apple with the new Mac they're releasing, and they've got an accelerator card in the computer now for accelerating ProRes, right? We see NewTek releasing a chip for NDI. So I think from the acceleration side, like we've reached a pinnacle point here where so much can be done on a chip now, which was we went away from that for a long time. For, you know, in the early days, everything was on a chip. Then we went to software defined. Now we're kind of coming back to the evolution of being able to do it on a chip. It's just a slightly different chip for perspective's sake. So it's giving us access to better, faster codecs, right? We can transcode faster. We can encode faster. We can do all these things faster, which are creating more real-time workflows. On the other side, the bad side is it's just a lack of consistency in the industry, right? And I think this is part of where the codec wars comes from. It's this concept that there's just too many codecs. Mm-hmm. There is no one winner per se. It's Sony's got theirs, Panasonic has theirs, JVC borrows from everybody else. Like literally, I mean, there's just too many codecs. I think at one point when we were deciphering MXF, I counted 26 or 30 variants of MXF. Well, it's a mess. And that, I think, is the thing that's actually holding the industry back, because you and I and, you know, the rest of us on this side of the, you know, the engineering side are always trying to come up with ways, and we spend more time deciphering what codecs people have, which ones they're using, how is the impact to that, how long is it going to take to transcode those,
file format?
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, you know, it's MXF, great. Well, what's the essence on the inside? And so it's, you know, I always liken it to a candy bar. I don't care what the wrapper says on the outside. Does it have nougat on the inside or not, right?
Exactly.
So I love that.
It's a mess. It's an utter mess in my mind.
So what does that mean for, you know, for creatives though? Sure, that sounds very democratic and very sort of free markety. That's a good thing, right? But what about the end users? Like what kinds of impacts does it have?
Well, I think from the end user's perspective, it's a lack of understanding of where to go. Right. I mean, people drive towards things like ProRes because Apple's behind it. But is that really the best plan to go with something that is driven by a hardware manufacturer that wants your almighty, you know, 99 cents a week? Like that to me is the struggle. It's where do I go? Which codec should I use?
Well, and then
because I'm going to buy a camera and I'm going to choose the camera on the lens, but then I'm restrained to the codec that's on the camera.
Yeah.
And is that the best codec?
And then what about like what do we do after the shoot? You know, what happens to the media? Do we transcode to Mezzanine? I mean, Premiere can edit this stuff, right? I can just drag it in. I can drag my card into Premiere and start editing, right? So,
well, and I think Premiere kind of screwed everybody up on that, of this concept of I don't have to use a Mezzanine codec. Hey, yes. Edit whatever you want, right? We're good. I mean, the old concept of Final Cut back in the day in 7 of having to render every time you made a cut, that forced you to think a little more. That forced you to really think through your codec choices. Now it's just like, hey, pull in whatever you want, slam it on the timeline, it's good. That's not a great plan. That's not a plan at all.
So, and I think the thing that I find the sort of conversation that I find myself having a lot with people is, you know, what happens to these files? Like, what is your expectation in terms of like, okay, so you've had, you know, maybe when Final Cut Pro 7 was end of life, maybe you switched to Premiere. Okay, we find that in many, many, many different facilities. People have switched to Premiere. So they're using Premiere. That's great. It's a great product. It's a great NLE. Can edit pretty much anything. But then, so we find that there's this gap between Final Cut Pro 7 is gone. Now we have Premiere. Maybe years have passed. I mean, that was, what, 8, 9 years ago? And now it's like, okay, so now we have this full SAN, and it's 500 terabytes, or it's a petabyte or whatever, and we can't find anything, and we need to bring in a MAM. So we have all these, you know, sequences in Premiere and all these projects and everything, and they're all referencing this source media that we just started editing with because we could. Now what do we do with all of it? And, you know, now we're talking about post-production and how post-production and media asset management and storage, because again, all these codecs, different sizes, different levels of compression, all that kind of stuff, different bandwidth requirements, and then different file structures and different ways of dealing with whether these files need to remain intact for the camera card essence or whatever it is to be like worth anything to anyone. Mm-hmm. So that's the discussion that I find myself having, is just trying to get people to understand why we needed to render and why it was not such a terrible thing, even though it took a little bit of time, right?
Yeah, the value of a proxy, right? And a proxy-based workflow. I mean, it's something that Avid sort of pioneered and everybody else said, why bother? Well, there's a good reason for it, mm-hmm, right? And because that's one of the things that, you know, we think about. It's like, well, it impacts the storage. How much space am I using? What's my connection speed? Do I have to have fiber channel? Can I go with a lower, you know, a compressed codec for proxy editing? I mean, these are decisions that we don't always think through, because the focus is, well, my NLE can handle anything, so why wouldn't I?
Sure.
Well, does your storage capable? Is the drive in your, you know, I mean, this whole concept of hanging a hard drive off my computer, it's fast enough because it's Thunderbolt. Is it? You know, and is it necessary? And what impact do I have by going with a direct connect drive versus a shared storage?
Yeah, you know? I get more scared as we've getting faster and faster SSDs in our laptops. Most people who haven't had the formative experience of a single hard drive or a RAID 0 and trying to work up to a RAID 5 and, oh God, we finally got a SAN and God, that's fast. Now we've got a couple of gigabytes a second in our laptop, and kids today just won't know the value of actual speed and aggregate bandwidth.
Absolutely. And the
thank you, Senior Kilberg.
You're welcome. Get off my lawn.
But you're right. I mean, look at this. So you guys can't see this because you're if you're not viewing. It's an NVMe drive in my hand.
Oh, I thought it was a candy bar.
I
seriously thought it was a candy bar.
But this is blazingly fast storage, mm-hmm, faster than a lot of SANs can be in a smaller environment. But these type of things push people away from, well, why would I bother investing in a shared storage solution when I can spend very little money to get something that's fast enough to edit my few streams, you know, that I'm working on. And tools like this kind of muck it up again, right? Yep. And stop people from thinking bigger picture. When we coach people on storage, I always, you know, they're like, well, here's what I've got in terms of local hard drives right now. And I'm like, well, that's great. That's what you have sitting on local hard drives, right? But let's think bigger picture. How much do you generate in a week, a month, a year?
Yeah.
What's the retention rate on that? What are the policies to that? Do you really need to keep all that stuff on storage? Better yet, how many of those are duplicated files because you've been swapping hard drives all over, copying from drive to drive, and you know your editor to your left borrowed a file, copied it to his drive. Now you've got 27 copies of that same file, right? So so hence the point for a MAM, but also centralized storage, because the reality is by the time we compile all that stuff, you probably have a third of the data you actually think you have, right? Or a third of the data you actually need to keep. So, but you can't do that if you're going to maintain this mentality of, I'm just going to have a drive that I plug into my computer for the moment.
Right. So we find ourselves, you know, on the file, just the sort of file level, because a lot of these media asset management platforms are very file-based. You know, here's a video that I want to ingest, and it's a file. It's a .mov or a .mxf, and I'm going to ingest it. Oh, but you know, when I dropped all this into Premiere, it wasn't a file; it was a camera card. You know, so how does that work? So that's a big thing.
The separate codecs coming in from cameras are complicated.
Yeah,
and what is the intermediary between there, and how do we organize people, right? We've got to structure that middle ground, because once you go from being two guys with two laptops or iMacs or whatever in a shop to a group of 20 people or 50 people, mm-hmm. and you have to have a couple of petabytes, and you've got to understand how 50 people work together, organize things together, and deliver things together, that's a much different story.
And you know, go ahead, Nick. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, and not everybody needs to be connected to that SAN.
Sure.
I mean, that's right. The biggest story. It's like we look at connectivity. Oh, I need everybody to be able to see the files. No, you don't. There are great tools out there to be able to share the files without giving access to the files, mm-hmm. which adds a layer of security and organization. I'm always worried about somebody deleting files. Well, don't give them access, right? Give them an interface. We're a very web-based world. We love interfaces, our phones, our tablets, all these devices, right? Well, there's an interface for that, just like there's an app for that, right? There's truly an interface for viewing content without having to access the content, which will allow you to centralize the storage, allow you to share the media, allow you to have a conversation around the content, right, with what to do with it. And then that's part of what helps break the codec issues, because now we're not worried about what codecs they're in, because we're going to deliver a web viewable codec version to you that allows Sue over in marketing, who's running on a PC without a lot of RAM, to play back what would be a ProRes file, right? That's the big delta. And it's thinking through that process of, hey, look, there's a better way to do this if you just take 5 minutes to sit down and whiteboard.
Yep. And that, you know, that sounds great for maybe a shop that uses one particular manufacturer's codecs. I mean, I know there's many, many different variants of MXF, for example. But on top of that, we have organizations that are really just tasked with managing media that they acquire from partners, whether it's like post-production houses or mainly post-production houses, but it could be, someone who's tasked with keeping an archive of, you know, this media from all over the place. Maybe it's not even video footage. Maybe it's audio and maybe it's images and all kinds of stuff. That really presents an interesting challenge for them, because they may not even know what formats all this stuff is in. They just get a drive because that's what they're supposed to do and figure it out, you know? So this codec war makes things really, really difficult for organizations like that, because they almost have to have like the Swiss Army knife of understanding how all these formats work.
And they're not typically in control of their media, right? When we think about it, like, the production industry is very transitory and klepto at the same time, right? So first, I mean, you've got content creators that are running around, and they're more freelance. They go from project to project. They work where they want to work. They work on projects they want to work. So because of that, your content's always coming in from different sources, and that content's being driven by the person behind the camera. What's their preference? Oh, I'm a Canon guy. I'm a Sony guy. I shoot Ari, right? So that content could be constantly changing. Like you said, the codec, you don't have a lot of control over the incoming side of it unless you literally control the entire chain. So getting that content in all these different formats, I mean, if I think of some of the corporate places I've seen, it's, you know, they change videographers every 2 years. Well, every time that change happens, the new one has a different preference on camera, right? Well, I prefer Fuji lenses, so I'm going to go with these instead, right? And so suddenly the content, you look through the cycle of media over several years, and you can see the constant codec changes throughout the years, and you can pin it to who the shooter was, right? And then add into the fact, I said they're kleptomaniacs. I was wrong. They're not kleptomaniacs. They're pack rats. Mm-hmm. They never want to throw anything away, right? Video was gold. I paid a lot of money. That camera was expensive. The freelancer we hired cost me a lot. Therefore, we're going to keep that asset, whether it has value or not.
Right. Video hoarding.
Yeah, video hoarding, right? I mean, there should be a show for this. I think this is, you know, an eventual video idea. Like, this is going to be, you know, it's you got the hoarder show, and then you get the video hoarder show. I mean, it's you know, it's that closet you open up, and there's 300 bare hard drives sitting on a shelf. Right. Oh, that was, yeah.
It's so, I mean, a 47-year-old man with a SAN in his basement who's ripped every episode of every cartoon known to man, and he's going to save the universe.
And he still has every Mac he ever bought. Right, because they're all lined up on shelves. The Bondi Blue one that's running the original Premiere 3.0. Yep. I mean, it's like literally goes way, way back. It's disturbing. Actually, the most nightmare one I ever had is I went to visit a client, and the client was stressing over whether they should start shooting in 4K. And I'm like, okay, well, that's, you know, let's talk about your workflow. And I go over to their office, and I said, well, where's your archive? And he opens up the closet door that was the water heater room. And there's like literally 50 hard drives, bare hard drives, just sitting on shelves 3 feet from the water heater. And I said, you know, my fear for you is not whether you should start shooting in 4K. It's whether you start archiving today, right? Like LTO now, you need to pull the trigger ASAP because, you know, that water heater blows, your entire archive's gone. Mm-hmm. History. You know, and that's, but that pack rat mentality that we have as video producers, content producers, is someday this moment could be valuable.
Yep.
Therefore, exactly. We need a place to put it.
Yep.
So what is that medium? And then how do we manage it? And what codec do we keep it in long term? I mean, do I really need to store it in ProRes?
Sure.
That's maybe I don't, right?
It's
right.
It's not just the acquisition or the capture of the media, it's the preservation.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's also, you don't want to waste storage capacity on storing data that's not actually there, right? If you have something that is SD and you're recording it, you know, via don't do that. You don't need a codec that is faster or can hold more data than there is actually data there.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, a buddy of mine was a Red Ninja, and he, one of the original Red Ninjas, and he was out helping people figure out how to use these cameras because at the time they were just too complicated and too unusable. And this was like, you know, the early versions. When he finally bought his own camera, he ended up buying a 1080p camera. I'm like, why? And he goes, well, the reality is, yeah, we shoot 4K on these Reds, but most people end up posting and producing in 720 and sending their content out, right? And so it was like, it was this idea of oversampling, right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly oversampling the data, but really the reality is it ends up watching it on a phone.
Yep. Absolutely.
Right. I mean, there's the whole idea of like someday there may be a special super remastered version of this in, you know, 10,000K. So yes, we need to shoot it in the highest possible quality.
It's got to be uncompressed. It's got to be raw because, you know, I need to hire somebody to de-bayer it for me. I mean, it gives somebody a job, so that's great.
Sure. But it's, you know, in many cases, it's a very distinct possibility that could happen. There are many times where I'm like, you know, I'm just going to use the example of Farscape, the sci-fi original.
Oh, yeah.
That, when was that on? 10 years ago? 15 years
more.
Ago?
More. Yeah. More.
Yeah. I loved that show.
Yep.
So you can watch it on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
And God, but not in HD. And there are parts of me that are just like, I wish they would have. Because, I mean, that's a beautiful show. Mm-hmm. It's very well done. It's very beautifully done. And love to be able to see it in HD, you know?
Yep.
So we wouldn't be talking about this today if it weren't, you know, I know some of our listeners are probably like, okay, yeah, all right. So you're not really telling me anything I don't already know.
Right.
So why are we talking about it? Is there any progress being made? Is there any change being made? You know, is this something for the market to solve? Is this something for Chessa to solve and people like us?
I don't know that I have the answer yet. I mean, here's what I know. Like, when we look at the broadcast industry, there is a somewhat governing board over the top of it, right?
Sure,
you got SMPTE, you know, you got NAB, you got a couple organizations that are really focused on, you know, things like codecs and broadcast standards and those types of elements, right? And so you look at SMPTE's pioneering a new way of transmitting video over IP so you can get off of the SDI cable, and they're calling it, you know, 2110 or whatever flavor it is this week because I think it changes literally every 2 months. But the reality is they're at least working towards a unification of how they're going to share information and data. And that includes how the audio tracks roll out, how the subtitles roll out, like how all of that data is going to flow so that it can be shared through stations, through, you know, ownership groups, through satellites. Great. Well, when I look at the post-production side of the industry, I say, where is that board? Where is that group that's defining a path like that for post-production around the globe? And I don't see it. I don't see anybody really putting their foot down and saying, guys, we don't need 26 variants of MXF. We don't need 6 versions of ProRes and 26 versions of Avid codecs, right? We need to find more ways to share media simpler between, you know, a better interchange format. And there really, I don't see a governing board on the post-production side. I don't see one place. Like, people ask us, well, where do we send people to get certified in this industry? Like, well, there isn't one. Like, because it's sort of driven by the manufacturers and the content. Sony drives their own codecs. JVC borrows. Panasonic drives their codecs. Red built their own. Arri decided to make changes to that and do their own. Everybody's doing their own thing because they think it differentiates themselves, but it's creating this splintering in the industry. right? Sure. I mean, how many versions of RAID are there? How many different file systems are there? Granted, they all have value, right, in that side of it. But in the end, it creates a window for you and I to help translate and communicate and pin the right technology. But it creates a lot of confusion for the end users defining which direction do I go.
So bad for the users, maybe good for us.
Oh, yeah. No. Somebody's got to be the trusted advisor, right?
Right. And the good news is they keep pushing the envelope. Quality keeps getting better. We get better and better media every year.
So there's reasons for
there's
all these
reasons.
Different
forms. Yeah, right. We're in the golden age of media creation. We have more awesome shows to watch than we ever have. Thank God, because we need to be distracted on a daily basis from everything else that's happening in the world. So, I think there are a lot of good things happening.
What about...
No, agreed.
Go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned, you know, Amazon Prime. I mean, the democratization of video sharing. I mean, if you think back in the early days to get a film produced, to get a film distributed, the amount of effort, you know, and you ended up just being a box on a shelf in a Blockbuster that nobody ever saw in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. That day is now flipped to now you're a title on a slider on Amazon, on Netflix, on Hulu, somewhere. But at least you have access and people can find you now in a way they never could before.
That's right. Yeah,
you know, so this ability to get content out there is phenomenal, right? I love it. Actually, you know, it's funny because Netflix, when you look at like Discovery back in the day for LTO distribution, right? They sort of put a line in the sand. This is how you're going to send content to us on LTO. Has to be in this format. Has to be done this way. I thought that was phenomenal because it sort of laid down a line and then you saw all these people adopt it.
Yep.
Well, now you're seeing that with Netflix, right?
Absolutely.
With their, hey, here's how you're going to deliver to us. Mm-hmm. And now other organizations like Disney and others are adapting to that same model saying, okay, cool. We're all going to sit in this same file format, the same codec translation, the same wrapper, so that we can transmit data easier between each other. But that's only on the distribution side. That's not on the ingest side. That's not on the codec side, on the camera side.
The post-production side. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Where all that content is sort of being manipulated and the stories are being created and told and, you know. It's interesting. We had talked about this previously, that in this post-production space, we don't like really have a specific governing body, but we also don't have a lot of education. You know, you think of, film schools and you think of like, oh, yeah, this person has a degree in film or whatever. This person might have a degree in cinematography or, they might be a producer. But like, what about education for somebody who's just going to become a media manager? It doesn't seem like that is a, really a well-outlined career path.
No, it's interesting because, you know, this I went to a major film school in LA and said, hey, were you guys interested in teaching media management and, you know, teaching DITs? And yeah, we have no interest in that whatsoever. I'm like, why? I'm like, well, you know, nobody comes to our film school to be a DIT or, you know, media manager. They come here to become the next Spielberg, the next big director, the next big name, right? And I'm like, great. How many of them actually get to that level, right? Really? I mean, how many of them are actually have their name in a kiosk somewhere, from that perspective, versus how many of them actually go out in the industry and find a job being a DIT? And as I was talking to the professors there, they started to say, well, you know, we always have one kid who's, it was really good DIT, and every group, every, you know, team uses that one kid.
Right.
And I'm like, awesome. Well, how do you cater to them? Well, they said they typically leave. I mean, what do you mean they leave? They said, yeah, they don't end up finishing school. Why? Well, because they end up getting a job.
Right.
I say, so what you're telling me is you're not catering to the actual jobs that are out there, because these students are getting plucked who have an aptitude to manage content, are getting plucked from your university before they finish school. You're not catering to them, but there's a need for them in industry. I mean, the whole thing that is sad, I at one time aspired to be an actor. Like, I thought I could be the next Bruce Willis. I went bald before he did. It didn't work out for me. But somewhere through I was listening to John Lovitz talk about the Screen Actors Guild and how 96% of the money was made by 4% of the members. And I thought, nuts, I'm on the wrong side of this.
Right.
And then when watching the film credits roll, I looked at the hundreds of people working and making a living doing what they loved. And that was a transition point for me to get from in front of the camera to behind the camera and look at the process. So that to me is sort of where this industry right now is. Where do you find that media manager?
Yeah,
where are you training them?
It strikes me because I went to a music school and, you know, I have a degree in audio recording, but my degree came from, it's a Bachelor of Music, and it came from a conservatory. And I had a very music-centered core curriculum that wasn't just about audio recording. Audio recording was my major, so I obviously had lots of classes in that, but I also had to learn about music theory, and I had to learn about counterpoint and orchestration and, you know, all of these things that are just inherent to the mechanics of music. We're not even talking about how to put notes together and, like, how to compose something that can move somebody emotionally. We're talking about just, like, the basic mechanics of how to read music, how to, you know, understand how the notes relate and things like that. I didn't appreciate it at the time when I was 20-something in college. I just didn't understand, you know, I was so above taking these courses. But now, even in my day-to-day work, I look back on that and just the perspective that I got from, you know, from having to sort of be involved in that and learning that. And what strikes me is that what we really need is we need to incorporate this kind of education into a core curriculum instead of saying, like, this is a major. You know, you're going to go to film school to major in media management. No, it's going to become part of yeah. the core curriculum that we teach as part of a film major or whatever.
Yeah. or even just multimedia communication.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
I mean, the reality is, I mean, I look at some of these curriculums because, you know, I'm helping my daughter kind of decide where she wants to go to high school, and she wants to do visual communications. And we're looking at some of these curriculums, and it's like, you must have a hard drive. You know, you must have a fast enough hard drive. And I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, so they're going to be creating content. They're going to be, and they're telling the kids to put it on a hard drive so they can, it can be portable. Well, when do they learn about NASs and SANs and how to organize and how to do a file structure? When do they learn about metadata in the naming schema or just building a naming schema, right? Mm-hmm. In a folder structure. Who's teaching that? And the closest I can see right now, there are a few universities, a few high schools, a few colleges around there that I have partners with that are doing a little bit of education, but the bulk of it is coming from way outside the industry in the librarians. The yeah. librarians get it.
Yep.
Right,
absolutely.
Because they've been cataloging things for years, mm-hmm. assets to them on a shelf. They're the ones taking that same thought process and realizing, well, all these new catalogs are going to be purely digital. So we need to look at how we translate our metadata schemas over to the digital world, how we start cataloging, you know, digital assets versus. And I think that's probably the one place where we're going to see these people come from, this next genre of employee. Because that's, you know, as we deploy MAMS, the number one thing is, well, who's going to run it for us?
Right.
You know, and that's what the end user, I mean, they're saying, well, I don't have time to run the MAM. Who's going to run the MAM? Well, you need to hire a librarian. That's the truth of it.
Yeah, firmly agree, firmly would promote that stance.
Yep.
I do firmly believe that every organization that has a media asset management platform needs a stakeholder within the organization that understands not just the platform that you have, but like just the concepts behind it. What does all of it mean? What does it mean for the editors? What does it mean for the producers? What does it mean for the organization itself to have this? And whether it's also about workflow orchestration and all that, you know, that is all important. And somebody within the organization that also understands all of the personalities behind all of those edit workstations and, you know, how that content is coming in and understands the pipeline in the organization and how the content is ingested and shot and then edited and archived and all that. Someone's got to have a vision within the organization, right? Yeah. So.
Yep.
No, and it's, you know, it's, we learned early on. I mean, we've been at the MAM game a long time. It's one of the reasons why I came over to this company because, you know, they were going into the market trying to educate the world on MAM early in the game. And one of the things that we learned early on, if you sold the end user the MAM and said, have fun with that, they were very unsuccessful. Right. Mm-hmm. So
right.
Then we realized, same as you, okay, you need a champion in your building. So we're going to come train you how to manage and maintain and utilize the MAM. And then we saw the success rate go up, right?
Because
then they were
yeah.
using it years later or months later, even because if you just drop them a piece of software and don't show them how it's going to change their life, it's not going to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or, you know, a particular product or platform may demo really well, but, you know, what I see on the screen may not equate to what I get when I double click that installer.
Look, every demo you see online has been rehearsed. I mean, that's the truth of
yeah,
it.
The
so,
good ones.
Well, you would hope, right? If you're not rehearsing it, get out. That is the form and function is to show the client what they can achieve. The problem with it is No two workflows are the same. No two environments are the same. They have the same needs. They have the same problems, but they're going to approach it differently. Their naming scheme is going to be different. Their workflows are going to be different. Yep. The content's coming from different locations. So it requires a group like yours to actually sit down with them and walk it through.
Yeah, absolutely.
And define it. And also force, because one thing we noticed, like one of the first trainings I went to was a client in the Midwest. And they, for a week, every day, there was one guy that would come in and put three videos on the screen. Which one do you like best? I'm trying to figure out what we're going to do for a proxy codec. And I'm like, okay. And you know, the whole team would vote on it. By day five, he still hadn't made a decision. Right. And it was just like this pure indecision, you know, of well, stop, pick one.
Just pick
one. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, somebody needs to help the client draw a line in the sand. If you let them as a committee define the metadata schema, it'll be 300 fields big, right? The reality is they're going to use 7. So it's, right. You know, it requires somebody to really hold their feet to the fire, push them to make decisions effectively. Because, you know, it was so funny. I had one of the guys at CBS On Air Promotions. He was a president there. He called me and he's like, look, we don't know what we don't know about MAM. Like, we just don't. We've never had one. So we don't know what to expect. So help us. Help us roll this out. Help us make decisions. You know, let's get a starting point so that we can start to learn and experiment so that a year from now, 2 years from now, we have a better idea of what our plan is.
Absolutely. And one of those questions in the qualifying process should always be, what kind of codecs do you work with?
Right.
Do your editors insist on editing natively in that codec?
Right. What's coming in, what's going out?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's spot on.
Yeah.
And that brings it right back around, right? It's helping the team to define what is the right codec for us to operate on. They will be better if they choose one than allow themselves to be run by 10.
Sure.
Right?
You know, I'm just going to say it again. Not everybody has the luxury of making that decision, but then it's back to what platforms handle many different codecs in their native format.
Right.
You know,
at least what are you going to render out? What's your mastery and delivery format going to be?
Right.
Speaking of delivery format, Nick, have you been running into much IMF lately?
It's picking up. Yeah. We're seeing it more.
We're seeing it more as well. Yeah.
Right. The interoperable mastering format.
Why don't you talk about the interoperable mastering format, Ben?
Well, so it's a fancy, fancy wrapper that can encapsulate multiple versions of files and multiple versions of audio files all into one awesome little bundle that then you can deliver to whatever destination needs it. And it's a way of encapsulating everything you might need. So if you want a proxy, done. You want the high res, done. You want Spanish and French and German and English and Portuguese, done. That's pretty cool.
So this is a delivery format, right? So we don't shoot an IMF.
Correct.
which, you know, and here's one of those points. Who developed and drove IMF?
Right.
The International Monetary Fund. No.
Bonus. I mean, this was defined by Netflix.
Right.
I mean, and so this is, you know, going back to that earlier, I mean, this is, you know, when you look at Discovery, who defined, hey, here's how we want you to deliver LTO. Netflix said, hey guys, you know what? We're sick of playing the format wars. Here's how you're going to deliver to us.
Right.
They drew a line in the sand and they put a standard out and they said, roll with it. And now, again, other people are adapting to it. What's taken time is the manufacturers to get to it, is the software companies to figure out, oh, maybe we should tie into this and, you know, figure out a way to export directly to IMF, you know, and do the packaging. And so, you know, little by little now we're seeing, I mean, I think a year ago there were maybe 2 or 3 companies that could deliver or could package IMF. Mm-hmm. And now they're, you know, it's every day that a new one pops up. Hey, we just added IMF. I mean, it was sort of like NAB 3 years ago, everything was 4K, then 3D, and, you know, and then we're that was on their sign, they ripped that piece out and replaced it with IMF this last year. So it's good because it is building a standard that people can work with. And there's an actual document that says, here's how you're going to do it. There's open source libraries for getting access to it and for building your own tools around it. Mm-hmm. And it's that first time when I can see, like, on the delivery side, awesome. We've all kind of agreed maybe there's a better way versus the wild, wild west.
So this, yeah, you say that. It's interesting, but this strikes me as a situation, you know, we just said that this was a standard developed by Netflix. So this is a situation where maybe the biggest player just stood up and said, all right, guys, this is how we're going to do it, right?
Free market, baby, free market.
Yep. It's interesting how that works and doesn't work, and depending on the situation and the scenario.
Well, I mean, you didn't see Avid jump on it, right? You didn't see Adobe get in there and say, "Ooh, we think we got an idea for how you can deliver," because there's not money to be made on that side for them.
Sure, exactly.
So you know, when you look at like the photochems and you know the big post houses of the world that are doing packaging for some of these large organizations, you know, they were deeply rooted in this. Because, you know, those are their primary clients. So, yeah, it is being driven by an entity. But that is how this market has always done over the years,
right?
Somebody ends up putting a line in the sand and saying, we're going to have to pick up a horse because there isn't one organization doing it for them or driving it for them.
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks to the adult film industry for giving us VHS. And now Netflix for IMF.
Ah, that's so true. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ben.
Way to bring it around.
Yeah, no.
It's, you know, I think the interesting thing now is how do we start to connect the dots for people? Not everybody's going to, well, look, 10% of the world of the post houses need IMF. That's the reality of it, right? Because how many of them are actually doing the final mastering to go up to Netflix or Hulu or you know, Disney or one of those? So it's such a small segment of the industry, but it's probably one of the louder voices right now because, hey, it's the new big thing. It's like a shiny new camera, something along that line. So the reality is now we look at, for the rest of the world, where are they delivering content to? They're going to YouTube, to Facebook, to their own OVPs. They're going to some CDN somewhere. Their stuff lands on Amazon. Their stuff stays in-house and only goes across to IPTV. The majority of that, in the end, is MPEG-4, right? Yep. I mean, it's H.264, it's H.265. Right. It's pretty standard codecs. So that sort of deliverable side really comes down to how do we simplify that delivery? Because in the end, almost anybody can create that final master for 80% of the distribution of the world. But how do we simplify that story to get consistency, to get checks and balances, to ensure that it's QC'd before it goes out, right? That's where those workflows come in now to say, well, let's build up a workflow that before you hit the upload button, you know your content's ready to go. Everybody's checked off on it, right? We're all agreed that this is the final file that's going out. And God forbid you actually QC more than Bob, you know, who sits over there and goes, oh, you got an extra frame of black there. You know, there's great software tools out there for doing this. And I think, you know, what I see is in the broadcast world, it's pretty consistent. In the high-end post-production world, it's pretty consistent. Hey, corporate America, it's time to get a QC app.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm really both happy and impressed by corporations like Netflix and Amazon who are pushing the boundaries on distribution and quality as well, because now we can stream 4K. Yeah. And they're working. I know Netflix has recently done a whole lot of work on the audio side and making sure that the audio, if you've got really fat pipes and really good bandwidth, that it's perceptually lossless. They still use a lossy codec, but by the time it hits your ears, it should sound still extremely good in what they're calling perceptually lossless. And so God bless them for innovating.
Yeah. No, I mean, and the reality is it's while they're doing all that upstream, we have to look at the downstream side. Where are most people watching this content, right? Is it a Roku stick, a Fire TV, their Xbox, or God forbid, you're like my children, you're stuck with a pair of binaural headphones on your iPad, right? I mean, that's the worst part about it, is that it goes back to that earlier message that we talked about, like, hey, if you're only going to distribute in standard def, why are you recording in HD? Well, here's the same concept, right? We're building at the highest common denominator, but the majority of the users are coming on devices that don't support that better audio or that better video. That'll change.
And the software's got to be smart enough to say, oh, I'm on this device, you get this audio or this video, which is amazing.
No, I mean, I think the whole concept of streaming and, you know, the segmenting of video to allow it to dynamically adjust to the bandwidth, to the user, to the device as it's happening, I think that's one of the most astounding things, because that's really what's allowed us to proliferate on the web. If we go back to the real video days, to the Windows Media video days, I mean, if you didn't have the player, you weren't in, and the player wasn't on your device, the player was only on your desktop, so you were landlocked to a really bad laptop or computer. Now it's like, oh man, we got this device in my hand that does 4K and the audio is actually pretty good. But my kid's over on his iPad, which is an older one, that's a lesser device. Doesn't matter. We're watching the same show.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely. Well, that's a good talk. Thank you, Nick Smith from JB&A, for talking to us today.
If your name really is Nick Smith.
Time will only tell.
Yes, thank you so much. This has been a very good chat.
Secret message. The crow flies at midnight.
So that's the Codec Wars for today on the Workflow Show. Thank you for listening. If you have any further questions, we would like to address them. So email us at podcast@chessa.com or visit us at www.chessa.com. I would like to say thank you to my co-host, Ben Kilberg.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. And I'm Jason Whetstone. This is the Workflow Show. Thank you.